Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm so pleased to welcome back once again Tainar Simpson, Chief of the Alderville First Nation, to our show. Good to see you again, Chief.
Great to be here, as always. Thank you, Robert.
A landmark settlement offer between First Nations and the federal government was announced on July 11th. The federal government says it will pay $47.8 billion in funding over 10 years for the long-term reform of First Nations child and family services. Now, before we get into the details and the history, I want to know, what was your reaction when you first heard the news?
Well, it's funny you say that, because this past week, I was at the Assembly of First Nations Annual General Assembly, and we knew the settlement agreement was coming down the pipe. We knew it was close to finalization, but we actually saw it unfold in real time while we were at the Assembly. The negotiations were coming down to the wire, and we were receiving constant updates while we were in Assembly in our Ontario caucus. And we knew it was coming down. So the day before it was officially announced, we were told that that we had almost reached an agreement. We weren't able to say anything about it. And then the next day, they announced that it had happened, and we were all very happy. We were celebratory. And then, of course, the discussions among the chiefs themselves about what this means started to begin. So it was very interesting to be in that context as the settlement agreement was announced.
Now, I appreciate that process, but how did it feel, though, emotionally, in terms of your background and your reaction to the announcement?
Well, to me, it felt it was a degree of satisfaction, seeing as after the residential schools were wrapping up and closing down across the country, starting in the late 60s, all the way through to the 90s, the child welfare system kind of took over from where the residential schools had wrapped up. So we knew that this was still outstanding, that some terrible wrongs had been committed against not only our children, but the parents of those children, with all the children forcibly removed from their homes. So to me, it meant, okay, that's the next step. But what does it mean? A dollar figure is fine, but it actually gets down to the services and where is that money going to go and how is it going to be achieve the goals it's supposed to. So it's over a 10-year period. So we know that we have time to get it right. But at the same time, you have to make sure that you get your course of action down pat before you start.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I've seen how these negotiations go, and I understand that you can't have 600 people at a negotiation table. Things will get out and get hammered down, and just the time commitments would make it unachievable. So I understand that that's how it goes. When we were negotiating our Williams Treaty Settlement Trust Agreement, the chiefs, for a lot of times, weren't actually involved at the negotiations. They were at some parts, but it was the negotiators, the legal team that was there at the table. So we know that there's a lot of unknowns that happen in this process. So I was aware of that, and I accept that. I'd rather get the end goal and maybe not have everything perfect than not have the end goal at all.
There is so much complex history around the treatment of First Nations children. Often you'll hear that the current child and family services system is broken. Previously, you have described the way children were taken away from residential schools and the 60s scoop as better known examples. How would you characterize the history of children and family services in the past?
Well, in a lot of ways, it was the continuation of the residential schools, where for any reason, the children were taken from their homes and put into foster and adopted homes. And often they were actually sold to non-Indigenous families for parents that didn't have any kids or wanted kids. So it was a very easy process. You would see ads in the paper for Indigenous children. It's part of what the 60s scoop was. And if you think about it, one of the reasons that your children could be seized was poverty. So you had all of these colonial and genocidal policies in the federal government aimed against Indigenous people that led to this level of poverty. And that in itself was a reason to seize the children again. So this is, we also know that once you take the children out and you support the family that's receiving the children, they're given a lot of money to look after those kids. But no one ever thought, hey, what if we give the money to the parents of the children we're going to seize, and then they won't be impoverished and they can keep their children. So that just never crossed our mind, or that they knew that they could do that, but that just wasn't the policy that they wanted to pursue at the time.
This is not the first agreement reached related to child and family services. In 2023, compensation was given to children and families under the First Nations Child and Family Services, Jordan Principal, and Trout Class Settlement Agreement. Can you explain that?
Yes. Now, if memory serves me correct, every child that was affected by that was, the number given was about $40,000, and then they multiplied it by the number of children, and I think there might have been some other things. So then they realized that that was the number, but it wasn't just about that. So we went back to the negotiation table and we thought, what else is required beyond this? And that's when we came up with that, the full $47.8 billion.
So this money that was announced on July 11th, how is it different from the earlier settlement? What makes it distinct?
Well, I think the umbrella of services that are going to be offered to compensate in the programs are going to be where that additional funds are spent. So if that original $40,000 per child is going directly to the children affected, or perhaps their families, the remainder for, I guess, what would it be? Maybe another $25 billion or so. That's going to go towards programs and services to make up the gap that has existed between non-Indigenous child welfare and Indigenous child welfare. And the reason that is being paid out, it's not just because there is a disparity, it's because the disparity was maliciously caused by the federal government. They knew what they were doing. They did this on purpose. It wasn't just a, oops, we made a mistake. They knew what they were doing.
So this money that's going to go towards creating a child and parental support system, family support system, has anybody put forward a plan or a proposal of how this is going to work, or is that part of the process you've got to go through?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. So some of the concerns of the chiefs at this most recent assembly this week were that the chiefs weren't involved in the process. But we are now convening in September a special chiefs assembly to hammer out what exactly this means, where the funds are going to go, how they're going to flow. And one of the concerns of the Northern Ontario First Nations through Anishinaabe Oski Nation was that there should be additional funds for remoteness. So everyone knows a dollar in Toronto doesn't equal, say, a dollar in Northern Ontario. So there's got to be some sort of a formula or recognition that their costs are going to be higher in there. So that was a degree of discussion among the chiefs themselves too. So we don't know exactly how it's going to be spent, but after September's meeting, we're going to have a really strong idea of what this agreement and services look like.
How will this impact Alderville?
Well, it's going to impact Alderville in the degree that we have been underfunded chronically for our child welfare programs. So it could mean that we have additional monies to put towards prevention, setting up homes for women that kind of like what the shelter did before, just where you can stay, not transitional homes in the sense that we know them now, but maybe in a child welfare traditional sense. So that would be increasing capacity, maybe being able to buy groceries for mothers and parents that could use it. So it will increase our basket of services and funds that we can offer to our families in need.
For those who might not be familiar, what child and family services do you currently have?
Well, we have two child welfare advocates, and we also have some prevention workers that deal with our families in need on a regular daily basis. So anything we can help to, anything that can support those individuals is what we'd be looking at. Just being able to maybe have a car and a driver to drive families around that don't have a vehicle, but they need to go shopping, they need to buy diapers, have a system where we can be able to provide those services for them.
What are the challenges that you foresee for Alderville as this starts to play out?
Well, it's overall, there's going to be growing pains because we're going to be ramping up our services in such a quick succession that usually we like to do things. Maybe we take too long to plan things out and make things happen, but we're going to be hitting the ground running and we're going to just make sure that these funds flow. But at the same time, you got to make sure you're doing the right thing with those funds. So we could be building additional homes for our young families. There's so many different things that are on the table. So right now the options are all over the board and we have to make sure we pick the right ones with whatever new funding we're going to get.
What's on your to-do list between now and your meeting in September to prepare for that deliberation?
Well, it's going to be a lot of talking with the other chiefs, our local Williams Treaty chiefs, some of the northern chiefs, the chiefs all across Canada. Maybe the chiefs in BC have different issues that they're concerned about. The chiefs out east might have a different concern. So I'd be mostly interested in getting the larger picture. So when we do go into the negotiating room with the other chiefs in September, we'll understand the big picture and not just our picture.
How about Alderville? Is there what work needs to be done in the community in preparation for September?
Well, I think probably an information campaign because we have a lot of families that are currently in need, but we have a lot of families that were affected by this in the past, and we want to get the information out to them. Funds have been earmarked for post-majority, which means children who were in care that aged out after they turned 18. So there has to be some help for those people that were affected negatively by the past wrongs. So we need to identify them, we need to reach out to them, and we need to let them know that we are going to be helping them in the near future.
Thank you so much for talking to us about this child welfare agreement.
Thank you. Very important issue. I'm happy to discuss.
Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tainar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tainar Simpson, the chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. I want to talk to you about the Ganaraska River. Now, I'm sure people are wondering, how can a river be a person? So let's begin by helping us understand the Indigenous perspective towards nature and specifically water.
Well, I say it a lot, but that's a very good question. When you look at our traditional knowledge and our traditional practices, we always considered Mother Nature to be our mother. The nature and its elements provide everything that we need. They love us, and it's up to us to love them back. And when you treat something poorly, it's going to have a negative effect on yourself and how they treat you. So when you harm Mother Nature, it's going to detrimentally affect you as well too. So we've always lived in an understanding where our actions have consequences, and we attribute things to nature and properties that maybe the mainstream Canadian population don't. So to us, it was a very simple thing to latch onto this idea of legal personhood because it's not too far away from what we had always believed and still do.
So explain to us this idea of attributing personhood to the Ganaraska River. What are we doing there?
Well, the genesis of that idea comes from the successful legal personhood granting to the Magpie River in Labrador and Quebec. So there was some concerns on the Magpie River that it was going to be dammed. There are plans, and it was one of the last free-flowing rivers in Quebec that hadn't been dammed up, because they've been doing so many dams and hydroelectric projects there that it was just inevitable it was going to happen to the Magpie River. And then the Innu stepped up and they said, we do not want this to happen to our river. And they were successful in their challenge. There was a beautiful CBC documentary on saving the Magpie River. I would recommend everyone to watch it. And then the genesis of the idea came as well when the mayor of Port Hope, Mayor Hakimski, she came to my office and she told me about this idea she had and if we would be interested in signing on. And we were thinking that absolutely, we would love to. I thought that we should also include Rice Lake on there. So now that's been added to our conversation. So it would be maybe the whole water system around the Ganaraska, as well as Rice Lake, because we know there's a lot of harms being done to these systems. There's overfishing, there's pollution, there's development. And we feel like these water systems are in jeopardy if we don't do something.
You mentioned the Magpie River and it got this status. Now, how is that significant in terms of setting a precedent?
Well, that's the big question. So the fact that it was able to be granted to the Magpie River legal personhood, it means that we can't stop there. We have to keep trying with the other important waterways, the other important bodies of water that mean so much to us. Water is life, and it's worth protecting. So to us, it's a no-brainer. We have, for generations, we've survived off of Rice Lake from the fish, from the rice, for transport. It's been our sustenance and our way of being. So it's a no-brainer for us to try to attribute legal personhood to what we have always seen as to be a living body.
Now, when you're talking about we, you're talking about Alderville and Indigenous people. This idea has to be bought into by a much larger community if you're going to be successful. How do you do that?
Yes, and that's where the Mayor of Port Hope stepped in and offered her support. So to us, it was a breath of fresh air to hear, a non-Indigenous community talk in these ways. So I was very impressed with her words. As an individual, she's great. I feel like we can work with her and achieve these goals. She is very steadfast in her desire to achieve this goal. So we will have the supports and the capacities of Port Hope, which is a larger town than we are, because we know it's going to be an expensive process. The legal process isn't cheap. But at the same time, we're going to be leading. Alderville is going to be leading this process because we do speak with a voice that we feel speaks also for water and the nature elements. Because it is something that we've always protected. As you might know, water protection and water walking has been a major focus of our people for the last several years. And we know that we got to keep that push up, and people are looking to us to keep up the fight.
The Magpie River was critical because there was going to be a hydroelectric dam that was going to be built. And when you look at the Ganaraska River, it travels through very developed lands. Now, it was reforested, but there are farms, there's lots of residences, there's businesses, and it also goes through a major urban center, Port Hope. This does not seem to be the landscape that is very natural anymore. Can you make an argument that says it is biodiverse and that there is really something here that needs to be preserved that's beyond what's already protecting it?
Well, I actually think that you might have answered your own question. Because there is so much development, what happens if that continues? What is the end result of unmitigated development, pollution, invasive species, fishermen that don't regard the laws, which we see a lot of? We need to be able to have those constraints on those aspects put in place. And there needs to be more than a slap on the wrist for if you say bulldoze down things and you put a house, oh, they can pay a fine. If you overfish, you pay a fine. There needs to be more repercussions than that. Otherwise, it's going to continue unabated.
Now, there may be some people that are listening that'll say, well, wait, hold on a minute. We've got environmental laws. We have bylaws. There's three levels of government that protect these places. How does making the Ganaraska a person going to change that in a way that is going to protect it in a more substantial manner?
Well, arguably, the laws of these different levels of government aren't doing enough. If they were, then we wouldn't need to be doing this legal personhood initiative. So the fact that it hasn't been working, the laws aren't achieving the goals that they're stated to do. They didn't go far enough in the first place. So we need to ensure that our watersheds, our headwaters are protected, because once the water is polluted and it doesn't recover, we're all going to pay the price. The fish, the plants, the humans, everyone that needs water to survive, which is everything, is going to suffer. So we are trying to protect it before it gets to that point, because we know that we will get to that point if we don't.
One of the rights of personhood is the right to be sued or to sue others. Can you explain why this is such a significant change from other forms of protection?
Yes. So if once you're a person, you can sue for damages. If, say, a developer comes and builds right on you and pollutes into you, you can sue them. But at the same time, say a fisherman has a bad day, or he falls in the water, or he catches a cold, can he sue the water for that? That's something that theoretically could happen. So we'll have to test that all in court. It's a challenge that I think we're up for. But at the same time, it's something that you have to take the good with the bad, and we will see what those cases could potentially look like.
It's my understanding that Indigenous contribution in this part is to have Alderville become a quote-unquote guardian of this waterway. How would that work?
Yes, so we already have water guardians. We have a lot of water walkers, people that in their spare time protect the water, look after the turtles, look after the rice beds. The fishermen are always in there. They know what's wrong with the stocks. They know who's doing what and improperly. So we hope to empower our current knowledge keepers and traditional gatherers that they will have the tools to be able to act on these breaches once they find them.
There's a lot of people who associate recreational uses for the river. One big group are anglers. Should they be worried about their ability to use the river in the future if all of this takes place?
Absolutely. So the reason we protect the waters is so that they can provide the fish for us and the rice. Living off of the water and the land, which water is part of our lands. When you talk about lands, you're also talking about water. So you want to make sure that they are sustaining you, and you have to draw from its resources. So we don't have a problem with the anglers and the fishermen that are working within the already established rules. Our problems are with the ones that don't. We know that there's fishermen that go in the spring when they're out of season. They take everything they can. We found nets, full nets of fish that had been thrown in and abandoned. So you have a whole big net of dead fish. So these are the practices that we need to not only stop, but punish once we do identify who it is. So I can see from my cottage on the lake, these fishermen that are out there starting as soon as the ice melts, they're out there, they're working legally. They've got these lights, you're not supposed to use lights, and they go all hours in shifts. So these are the things we've known, we've reported them, nothing happens. We want the ability to be able to stop and prosecute these rogue fishermen.
What about other recreational uses, such as the float your fanny down the Gani annual event or boating and so forth?
I think if it's done in an ecologically sustainable and responsible way, I think that's okay. There's definitely certain practices that aren't good, like when they would do those rubber ducky races and drop like 10,000 rubber ducks in the river, and the first one to pass a certain point would win. Like half of those ducks are going to end up in the grasses and in the animal's digestive system. So that is what I would consider to be not a good initiative. So float your fanny down the Gani. I think we'd need to take an assessment of that and see, is there any damage being done? At this point, I don't have enough information to say if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a fun thing and people love it. So it's one of those things that if it's sustainable and it's fine, then I say more power to it.
You can imagine that there's going to be a lot of people get upset about this. How do you respond to those people?
Well, anyone that likes the Ganarasca, likes Rice Lake, wants it to continue to thrive, wouldn't have a problem with it. So I would say that people that want to abuse the water systems would be the ones that are upset. So to me, I'm fine if a few people get upset about it, because that's our job isn't to make everybody happy.
Thanks so much for talking to us today about the Ganarasca River. We move on now to, I know, one of your favorite parts of our conversations, and that is the public service announcements. So what's going on for the next month?
Yes, well, considering when this is being recorded and when it's going to be broadcast, I'm going to say that the 30th annual Alderville Powwow was a great success, probably the best one we've ever had. Hopefully that will prove to be true. For what's coming up, we have July 20th is our student awards, and this is a wonderful awards that we have to honor our students, young and old alike. And that's going to be at the community center. It's our 34th annual one, and I've got a couple kids who might be up for awards, but we will see. I would like to just announce that we always have men's drum every Thursday night at Hilltop. So if you're an Alderville member, male, and you want to start drumming, or you've been drumming, don't forget every Thursday. And for the women, we have women's full moon ceremony, and it's usually on the night of the full moon, but not always. Upcoming ones are going to be August 19th and September 17th, also at the Hilltop Wellness Hub. And coming up, we also have on August 3rd is the return of the Alderville Regatta. And this is something that's been years in the making. With COVID, we had to stop the regatta and it never fired back up. So this is going to be the first time it's back. And it's probably going to be better than ever. We've got new docks coming in place. There's going to be a slew of new events. We are going to have some vendors and more food than we've ever had before. So we hope that this is going to be a success beyond our wildest imaginations. And coming up, we have an archaeological liaison course. So if you are an Alderville member, and you want to learn how to be an archaeological liaison to go out in the field and ensure that proponents and developers are being archaeologically responsible, there's going to be a program from August 6th to August 30th. It's going to be facilitated by our consultation coordinator, who has a doctorate in archaeology. So if you want to maybe start a new career or do something in the seasonal summer for extra money and help out the community, please contact Julie at the band office. And finally, on September 16th, we have a deadline for the new cemetery sign. So Alderville Cemetery, our sign is in, it's not in the best of condition. So we are going to put in a new sign, and we are looking for all Alderville members to have their say on what they want it to look like. So if you're an artist, or maybe not even an artist, and you want to see if you got a good cemetery design, please submit it to Orly at the band office. And that's by September 16th. And that concludes my announcements.
Chief Tanner Simpson, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tanner Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.